When your furnace or air conditioner quits, you need it fixed, fast. This is Dennis Sullivan, president of CARE Heating and Cooling. Our technicians are paid to fix your HVAC system, not sell you a new one. We show up on time, diagnose the problem, and get you comfortable again, without the high-pressure sales pitch. It's our commitment to honesty and craftsmanship that helped us win the Lennox Partner of the Year Award and a BBB Torch Award for Ethics last year. So, call CARE Heating and Cooling at 1-800-COOLING or book an appointment online at careheatingandcooling.com. When you need a company you can trust.
Breaking apartment news. The Champion people, you know, the people with the good apartments, bring you River Park of Dublin with this amazing deal.
No rent until 2026. Live in one of the coolest places in the city, right by Bridge Park, and you will not pay rent until next year.
I don't believe it.
I lie a lot, but not about this.
River Park of Dublin. Great location, great amenities, and now a great special. Okay, now go to livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
It's the Wonky Show. Mark's been at Tory party conference. We'll catch up on all the gossip. OFS is applying a spelling test across the sector. SA males are going to be banned. And is online diversity training more hassle than it's worth? It's all coming up.
Actually, nobody is disputing that written English, written communication is important. I think, you know, if you actually look at the assessment policies, most of them will stress that effective communication is an important part of learning outcomes. What's being picked out here is very, very specifically spelling, punctuation, and grammar.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to help us munch our way through conference carbs and coffee, as usual, a phalanx of fantastic guests. In Gravesend, Selena Bolingbroke is a consulting fellow with the Halpin Partnership. Selena, your highlight of the week, please.
Bit of a slow week for me, Jim, but I was pleased to see we had some inclement weather Monday night, Tuesday here in Gravesend, and everything that I'd spent time fixing over my summer holidays has not yet broken, has not yet flooded. So that was my highlight.
Excellent. And in South East London, Amitai Doku is a consultant at the Nous Group. Amitai, your highlight of the week, please.
Oh, well, it's got to be the respite that we had for some hours from both WhatsApp and Instagram and Facebook the other day. And I was slightly disappointed to see when I went back onto WhatsApp, I only had one message. So
were you back on your Bebo account?
Yeah.
Excellent. And in Winchmore Hill, Mark Leach is Wonky's Editor-in-Chief. Mark, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, Jim. My highlight of the week was the Wonky dinner at Conservative Party Conference in Manchester. We do this every year because it's always fun to kind of create a little HE enclave for all the sector types that come to party conferences, a safe space for them, and just so nice to reconnect with so many people not seen since before COVID.
Excellent. So yes, funnily enough, we start this week with Conservative Party Conference. This week, party members, MPs, lobbyists and the media and a whole bunch of other hangers-on descended on Manchester for the annual shindig. So, Mark, do we know what levelling up means? Yeah.
Well, it's a work in progress, and I think that's kind of the point of this party conference. It was jolly interesting, though, to listen in on some of the debates happening across the Conservative Party when it comes to levelling up and a host of other issues relating to economy and society. Now, for those who haven't been to Tory Party Conference before, it's never very strong on policy detail. We were told that Boris Johnson was going to give away some rabbits and in his speech this week, but that ended up being, again, quite light on detail. Because the elephant in the room and the many sweaty rooms across Manchester Central Convention Complex was the spending review and lots of decisions pending later this month. So we didn't get any big giveaways, but lots of interesting conversations about levelling up, as I say. So I think for me, one of the big takeaways was that despite, you know, lots of valiant efforts by different sectors and different industries to try and define what levelling up means for them and kind of try and put meat on the bones, lots of interesting chatter about how kind of none of that matters, and you know the sort of the grand economic mega projects and slogans don't really mean anything to anyone. And so some of the more interesting conversation was about how levelling up could actually do things for people in their lives. I know it sounds controversial, but a consensus.
I mean, the impression I got, Mark, was it was all a bit monkey tennis insofar as, you know, there's a phrase and then everyone's like, monkey tennis? Oh, yeah, we'll deliver monkey tennis. We're the sector that can help you deliver monkey tennis. And it's like, I think we forget sometimes in HE, don't we, that every other sector is trying to put, you know, fit themselves into the latest kind of fashionable thing.
I mean, that's just how policy works. Yeah. I mean, that's just policy for you, Jim. I mean, Rachel Wolf from Public First has a really good line about this, which was that, you know, levelling up's not going to do anything unless people can see improvements. You know, their streets look nicer, they can get appointments with the local GP. You know, if that's and where they've struggled before, that's the sort of thing that levelling up means to them. So, implicit in that, I think, is some advice to universities, which is, you know, maybe come down from the ivory tower and look at how, if you really want to contribute to levelling up, not just the slogan, look at how you can open your doors to engage more people. And I think that does actually really chime with how a lot of the sector's thinking about the civic agenda and things like that. So the two can be quite hand in hand.
And there was this interesting exchange with Gove, wasn't there? So before you talk about that, let's hear a clip.
Now, I wouldn't be much of a journalist. I have a very quick question here to Michael Crick.
Yes, Mr. Gove, there are five universities in Greater Manchester. One good way to level up, maybe a bit more long-term, would be to establish new universities in places like Doncaster, Grimsby, Barrow, Thanet, perhaps, and some of those other northern citizen towns that don't have them right now, because it generates economic activity, particularly if those universities concentrate on STEM subjects.
Thank you.
Yes, I agree.
There we are. Thanet University, here we come, everyone. well, to stop a lot on that one, mate, obviously, yes. There is a big focus on vocational education at the moment, and skills plays a big part in to levelling up. You know, what do you think about Tony Blair's famous half the country going to university? Was that a mistake? And do you think less people should go to university?
I don't think the ambition was a mistake. I don't think fewer people should go to university. But I do think it is the case that for a long period, there has been a neglect of what is required in order to ensure that you have technical and vocational qualifications of sufficient rigour, which are also those which the employers want and need. And that's why I think that Michael's point is so important. You can have higher education institutions, you can call them universities. There's a difference between what some universities offer, which is attractive, but necessarily only perhaps suitable for, you know, some, and what we should be concentrating on, which is precisely ensuring that people can have at least 3 years of high-quality technical and vocational education in scientific, engineering, and mathematical subjects, which prepare them better for the world of work. Now, it may well be that the institution that you attend is called a college rather than a university, but if it's high quality, if you're particularly working closely with industry, and at the end of that you have a qualification that is deemed rigorous, then that seems to me to be absolutely the way in which we should think of going. In a way, it's not just that we're reinventing the wheel, it's not just that we're going back to polytechnics, but, you know, one of the five universities that the Michael mentioned, UMIST, was founded on the principle that you should do precisely that. And I think that if you look at other countries which have been both successful economically and also successful in terms of social mobility, people have been in education for longer, but the education hasn't necessarily been, I'm nothing against this, being in a seminar room discussing the hermeneutics of Spider-Man. It's been, you know, looking at some of the more, directly scientifically rigorous routes into work.
Bad news for scholars of Spider-Man.
Well, this was a fascinating exchange, and Michael Crick is absolutely brilliant at asking questions, and it was absolutely perfect question that right there, because what I think that shows is that Michael Gove, a lot has been written, a lot of ink being spilled about how Michael Gove is there to do levelling up, but also implicitly win the next general election. And I can't help but wonder if Michael Gove has his eye on actually the next kind of several elections, because I think he's smart enough to know that plugging some of the desperate higher education cold spots with some sort of provision is going to improve lots of people's life chances in lots of important ways. That definitely runs counter to the prevailing narrative coming out from the rest of his party, which is about prioritising vocational and skills routes. The two can go hand in hand. And, you know, it's not like we're going to see a massive university challenge style universities kind of building agenda as was tried to kick off in 2008. But I think if he's thinking about the next several elections, We're going beyond, you know, you couldn't, for example, you couldn't, you know, you couldn't get a university up and running by 2023 or 2024, the next general election, certainly wouldn't be making a tangible difference to people's lives. But if he's thinking about the long term, he's smart enough to know that higher education is a really great way of leveling up, literally. That is a really interesting data point. And I think a number of people in the sector want to capitalize on that conversation with him.
I think one of the things that we might reflect on in terms of the university challenge, as Mark mentioned, 2008, last sort of gasp of breath from the last Labour government in terms of expanding university centres in cold spots in the country, is some of those that opened then have now closed. I think that probably on reflection there, you know, there does need to be this real consideration about what that university centre will be doing in the long term, both in terms of student demand, but also this really crucial part of the levelling up agenda, which is about that intersection between higher education, further education and employment and industrial growth. And I think part of the policy gap that remains, and actually I would say this across, you know, looking across all the party conferences this season, is we don't have sufficient joined up strategic planning across all of those areas. You know, we don't even really manage to join up the post-tertiary sectors. But, you know, with no industrial strategy, and we've heard a lot this week from Boris Johnson about his, you know, the reasons why we are struggling with productivity. I think, first of all, people are not convinced by his analysis of the problem. But more importantly, at the moment, from a, you know, government department perspective, there is no policy and there is no strategy to provide solutions to that. So I think from my perspective, we know as a sector how much value universities can bring, not just to individuals, but to communities and to industry. And I think all universities will be, you know, ready to do their bit in their local area. There is never a presumption that they would not want to do that. But people need long-term strategy and, you know, helpful funding infrastructure to be able to put their investment of time and resource into that.
Amitai, here we are at the, you know, the end of party conference season. And I mean, actually, you know, there's an argument that says all of the party conferences were pretty light on, you know, grasping the big challenges of the day. What's your sense of where, you know, wider politics is at in terms of kind of solving people's problems and, you know, addressing the big global challenges?
Look, I mean, I completely agree with Selena's last point about that kind of lack of strategy. But I think it's across the whole spectrum. Universities are in a really weird place in terms of, you know, this big narrative of them being caught up in the culture war debates and discussions, which means that actually puts it slightly at odds with this idea that you'd want to sort of invest more in them because they're seen as sort of problematic. But on the other hand, I don't think either Labour or the Conservatives have really grasped fully or made that calculation about how universities can be key to that levelling up piece and really improving chances and experiences and opportunities for people, which I think is quite odd. I think the sector does have some responsibility for that. I think the approach to
Breaking apartment news. The champion people, you know, the people with the good apartments, bring you River Park of Dublin with this amazing deal.
No rent until 2026. Live in one of the coolest places in the city, right by Bridge Park, and you will not pay rent until next year.
I don't believe it.
I lie a lot, but not about this.
River Park of Dublin. Great location, great amenities, and now a great special. Okay, now go to livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
There's been too much of an approach of asking for bits here and there, asking for funding for this, asking for free, like, you know, caps on this, asking for, you know, we're actually, what we haven't done is, as far as I'm aware at least, made the much more holistic case of if you invest X in HE in this way, this is the return for you in by 2030, 2040. I've not seen that done. And I know that's going to be quite hard because we have a very big and diverse sector, but I've not really seen anything really compelling to set the agenda with either political party in this space.
Mark, you've been watching these things for a long time. Where do you think our sort of, you know, our politics is at as a after this little season?
Well, it just confirms to me that things are basically as random as ever. I mean, you say lack of strategy. I mean, I think that's pretty pretty generous. I mean, this is a government, you know, I mean, and I think led by a person who likes to make decisions quite at last minute, on the hoof, goes with his gut. And, you know, I think that, you know, I think that filters down to all sorts of kinds of policymaking. The sort of dangerous thing about that, though, is that, you know, you get different kind of power centres emerging. And, you know, Whitehall, I think a lot of people kind of imagine Whitehall as like a ship with the captain giving orders and someone steering the ship. It's actually lots of different centres of power. And of which the Prime Minister...
I tend to think of it as like a set of bumper cars at the fair.
That's another good way of thinking about it. And what's interesting is, you know, you get people working on agendas and furthering them in surprising ways. Now, there's a lot going on in the Department for Education right now relating to universities. More of that we're going to see later this year. There's a lot going in the Treasury, because we know the spending review is going to have some significant pain for universities coming up. And the two are obviously closely related. There's a lot going on in BEIS and science policy. So I think the best the sector can do is to pick up all of these different strands and engage with them and kind of just assume that no one's talking to each other. I think you just really have to rehearse everything from the ground up every single time. I think that's kind of fine. It does also present a bit of an opportunity, but it also shows, you know, I mean, I have it on good authority that the funding consultation that was going to have details of, you know, the graduate repayment threshold and everything else was largely agreed in Whitehall, went to number 10 for final approval, and that was right before the Afghanistan debacle. And literally the slate was wiped clean, and it's really been stuck in number 10 ever since. And now it's kind of have to be part of the spending review, and it just shows kind of how much external events can affect these kind of things and could well affect the actual decision, because, you know, 2 months is a very long time in politics, and these things have a habit of getting renegotiated as kind of other numbers are filled in.
Well, exciting times. Good. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Libby Homer, and I'm Director of Student and Library Services at Anglia Ruskin University and Chair of the Sconnel Content Strategy Group. This week, I've written about the start of a collective action to bring together a group looking for substantial and meaningful change in the e-textbook and e-book market, and really launching a call for action by this group. It's an unprecedented call for action for libraries and publishers to ensure that we have sustainable models for providing students and other readers with access to electronic books and electronic textbooks. And the call is supported by Sconnel, JISC, Philip, the eBook SOS campaign, RL UK, NAG, and a number of purchasing consortia. Really, we're in a situation where models of purchasing are unsustainable and based on outdated beliefs on how people used to buy physical textbook copies. We are asking publishers to be transparent about pricing, offer new models for purchasing, and allow libraries access to what they have paid for in perpetuity. None of this is particularly unreasonable, but it does promote fairness and inclusivity. The situation that we have at the moment and the way that we buy this sort of material is outdated. It lacks transparency, and more importantly, is denying fair access to not only our students and staff at HE institutions, but also, for example, NHS clinicians and the wider public. So I'd like to encourage podcast listeners to take a read of the call for action and utilise it when working with publishers. We're just getting started on this one, so we welcome your thoughts on this. Thank you.
Now, meanwhile, this week, the government has announced that it will outlaw commercial essay writing services in England as part of the Skills and Post-16 Education Bill. Amitai, this has been a long time coming.
Absolutely. So, as you said, honestly, I was just reflecting on this, having, you know, been, you know, involved in obviously NUS and student politics. I mean, this has been something that has been running for such a long time. So, yes, absolutely, a long time coming. And really, really good news that the regulations would make it illegal to provide, arrange, or advertise cheating services for commercial gain. And it's been reported that this has increased during the pandemic. So really, really good to see that. And obviously, a lot of work has gone in from QAA, from UK, from NUS, and other students and students' unions as well. I think just a couple of reflections. The first, it's sort of surprising it's taken this long, given that there's not a great deal to be, you know, it's sort of no skin off the government's back to do this. So it's slightly curious as to why it's taken so long to do. But I think there are two things coming out of it. One, it needs to now be effectively enforced. So it's unlikely that, you know, these people are going to shut up shop and just go home and, you know, go and do something else. But at the same time, you've got to recognize and think about what are the factors that are driving students into using these services as well. And I think that's, we've really got to think about the support for students academically and also pastorally, in terms of welfare as well, to make sure that students are well supported, that, you know, this sort of practice doesn't even come on their radar, particularly, I think, for international students who, you know, passing or not passing isn't the same as for a domestic student. It has such bigger implications, both in terms of the amount of investment they've made into their education, but also in terms of visa requirements and the rest of it. So I'd like to see us really rally round and think about, again, you know, for those students who are using SA Mills, you know, what is the support available that we can offer?
Selena, last time I checked, the internet allowed you to talk to people in other countries than England. So this is, I mean, this isn't going to make a blind bit of difference, is it?
No, I think that's the key thing. You can create and pass a law to outlaw these services, but I think it's going to be very difficult to implement. You know, very few companies are going to offer themselves explicitly as SA cheating services. What they will offer is a service that provides, you know, model answers, illustrative essays. There's a million different ways. And we already know from other parts of social media that there can be things that are, you know, criminally outlawed, but they are not, that it's not possible to really implement and to deal with some of the services that are out there. I think, as Amate said, the real way to tackle this is about thinking about assessment, thinking about student support. I mean, I think we all know from a teaching and a learning point of view that really good quality assessment is not something that happens just at the end of the course. It's generally it's formative in its process, and you know, as an academic, when you're assessing your students, if you know your students, you can tell. I've certainly had that experience myself, where you can tell if somebody is using other people's words, whether they've plagiarized or whether they've just wholesale taken an essay from a commercial provider. So I think it leads to more, you know, deeper questions, really. But that puts universities in a very difficult place. As Amity said, I think over the last year, there have been certainly some opportunities from a teaching and learn perspective, but far more challenges that have arisen when we have pivoted to having so much done online.
Amity, look, you know, if we're worried about people writing essays, partly because, you know, we're probably only 18 months away from AI being able to write your essay for you, let alone a student in another country, and we're worried about high stakes exams, and we're also, you know, and if the only alternative is, you know, a kind of, you know, everyone does a presentation or a, you know, a Viva, what do you do next? Because, you know, these more creative types of assessment just don't feel scalable in a period where we're probably going to have the unit of resource crunched on us.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I don't have the kind of specific answer, but I do think it needs to be looked at, and I think it needs to be looked at across the sector. I think many universities are probably steeped, not probably, are steeped in the traditions of assessment and feedback. It's comfortable. We sort of know how the exam cycles run. The structure of the exam year. The structure of the year is you know, a lot of it comes down to when the exam season's is and the rest of it. So it's going to require a real shift. But I think now really is the time. Like, I just don't understand. You don't even need essay writing skills in academia. You know, it would be more effective if you're trying to train people for academia to get them to work together collaboratively on papers. And it's certainly not something that is used in the outside world. I've not, you know, written any essays since I've left. So we all know this. We all know this, but we kind of just carry on. But it is going to require a big shift. And yeah, it might not be scalable, but that might not be the right sort of question, really. It's what is the most effective way to ensure that students are achieving the learning objectives that they have. And I really don't see the sort of traditional model that we use of exams as the solution to that.
Mark, obviously in other parts of the education sector, that all the gossip around Tory party conference was the government's restatement that exams are the best way to test students. But I mean, the other thing is, it was interesting, wasn't it, that Alex Burghardt kind of appeared and launched this, and he's just kind of emerged suddenly as, you know, someone who can get something done.
Well, more than that, possibly, Jim, even Minister for Students, do you remember that?
So
Alex Burghardt has, in the reshuffle that took a long time to fill the different bits to filter down in Whitehall, but Alex Burghardt's joined Michelle Donlan as a Minister for Apprenticeships and Skills. But he does have a surprising amount of higher education in his brief, including student experience, WP, university's response to COVID, and all sorts of things. And he was given the announcement of the essay mills ban this week at Tory party conference, which is a hard policy, and we can definitely criticise, you know, its effectiveness over the long term and different types of assessment, you know, what might be needed in the future. But, you know, ministers don't often get given policy to announce at conference. So that's, you know, that's very interesting. He also is a former academic himself. He was a history lecturer at King's, I believe, and he's worked in Number 10, and he's also very impressive when you see him speak about education. He's got a lot to say.
Breaking apartment news. The champion people, you know, the people with the good apartments, bring you River Park of Dublin with this amazing deal.
No rent until 2026. Live in one of the coolest places in the city, right by Bridge Park, and you will not pay rent until next year.
I don't believe it.
I lie a lot, but not about this.
River Park of Dublin. Great location, great amenities, and now a great special. Okay, now go to livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey, he's pretty thoughtful. So I'm going to hazard that we're going to see a lot more of him in the coming months. And he's definitely someone that the sector is going to need to take seriously.
Now, every week on the show, we delve deep into the sector's past to discover stories of how things were and how things came to be. With Nottingham Trent's Academic Registrar Mike Ratcliffe, here's the hidden history of HE.
So the pass degree was the original degree. Reforms in the 19th century led to the creation of honours exams, top-ups, whereby you course, but you added an honours exam. You could have more than one honours exam as more were added. Slowly, the requirements for honours became more onerous, so the requirements for the pass degree faded away. In the 19th century, this led to a clear distinction between the reading men and the pass men. The reading men, who were following the honours courses, grew in number. The pass men were seen as a good part of the mission of the university, what Vivian Green describes as the finishing schools of the upper and middle classes. There were plenty of examples of how pass men got on perfectly well with their studies, but not so well with the examinations. As an example, Henry Chaplin was chastised by the Dean of Christchurch, who said, "As far as I can gather, you seem to regard Christchurch as a hunting box. You're hardly ever in college, and I must request you to either vacate your rooms to make way for someone who can benefit from their studies at the university." The student replied, "But what do you expect me to do?" The Dean said, "You must go in for an examination." And so he did. It was a bit of a novelty to him, but he did very well. So the Dean summoned him back to say, "You've done tremendously well with this. I must congratulate you on your excellent performance. But now you must go in for the honour schools. You've shown us your abilities. You will become a credit, not only to this house, but to the university, as I expect you'll be very successful." But Chaplin said, "If only you told me before, I would have done so. But after my last interview with you, in which you intimated that I'd have to vacate my rooms, I'm very sorry to inform you that I arranged to go on a trip to the Rocky Mountains." Actually, passing the exams never really occurred to him as an important part. It was matriculating in the college that was the thing that he was after, and he was having a fine time. He didn't really want to take part in the exams at all. Other students would take part in the pass exams, but survived to the end. So, in 1909, the Master of Cambridge's Magdalen College indicated that only a quarter of those people who'd matriculated actually took the degree. Very large numbers didn't take part in this. But pass degrees continued. Honours degrees became the thing that the aspirant people would take, but a pass degree would sit there. So by the time we get to the Robbins Report, we have this confusion. There were still honours courses and pass courses. Some universities, you took the pass course and then moved on to the honours course. Some places, you could be on both simultaneously and you would decide where to go, but they were still treated as separate. Quite often, they were seen as the solution to the specialisation question. You take a pass degree, it was more general. Only those people who wanted to specialise could take an honours degree. But of course, we know, in the end, honours wins out. past becomes just the path that we now get to. If you don't succeed, you get a past degree. But that was the original part. That was the original degree that everyone took.
Now, next up, universities should consider students' spelling, punctuation and grammar when marking exams and assessments, the Office for Students argues in a new report. Selena, what on earth?
Yes, Jim, what on earth? The whys and the wherefores. I think we just have to go back a little bit into, it's a very thin report. I don't usually mind that. 10 pages, though. 10 pages.
I don't think their heart's in it, Selena. I don't think they want to be doing this.
Well, you know, I think I've written essays without the support of S.A. Mills. I've had no heart in the subject that have at least gone beyond 10 pages. So in that sense, in fact, I did think if you're going to write a report about assessment practices that look at spelling, punctuation and grammar, I suggest, and I am not the person to do this, but there could be a kind of wonky competition. So the first listener to alert us to the first grammatical spelling or punctuation mistake in this report should win a wonky pen or badge or
a selfie
with Mark Leach.
A mug, definitely a mug. If Nicola wasn't going through that final report with a red pen, yeah. She definitely would have missed the trick.
There will still be mistakes there. I know that. So, yes, this rather, I think, rather bizarre report has its origins in a series of press reports in the week leading up to Easter back in April earlier this year, because somebody had picked up Hull University had an inclusive assessment policy which asked staff, and I use the quote marks from the newspaper article, not to dock marks for spelling errors, as requiring good written English could be seen as elitist. So I think what probably surprised everybody, and it was probably a slow news period given it was the week leading up to Easter, was the way that quite a few phone-ins and newspapers jumped on it. In fact, the Daily Mail actually claimed in their article that nearly half of university vice chancellors were concerned about their students' literacy, which is not evidenced in any way, and certainly wouldn't accord to what I would say.
Nearly half of the one VC we talked to.
I know! Half of him was concerned about his students' literacy. These are not the things that we see coming up on Board of Governors' risk registers or, you know, for regular discussion at SLT meetings or faculty board anytime soon. So the poor unfortunate institutions that happen to be named in these press reports, it wasn't just Hull, Worcester as well, and University of the Arts London. But what's strange about this is this then created sufficient impetus of concern on behalf of the regulator to decide in June that it needed to do a mini review and look at several institutions. They don't actually tell us how many institutions. I'm going to come on to the method in a moment, but they don't actually tell us in this report how many institutions they spoke to. They certainly don't tell us who they spoke to, what type of institutions, where they were based. It is rather thin in that sense. But I think that is the most bizarre thing, which is that just a few press reports was really the evidence on which OFS decided that there needed to be an examination of this subject and that there was valid concerns. They kind of cite a CBI survey from 2019, which said that a quarter of their respondents were dissatisfied with the literacy and numeracy skills of young people. But actually, in that same survey, those same employers said that they were much more dissatisfied with the fact that graduates didn't get relevant work experience and that graduates' wider characteristics, behaviours and attributes were lacking in some way. But we've not yet seen the OFS mini review of those particular areas. So I think the evidence based on this kind of the validity of concerns is pretty thin. The report itself, I mean, really what it sort of tries to focus on is the idea that inclusivity should not be at odds with the assessment of technically proficient standards of English. It doesn't actually name what that constitutes, in terms of technically proficient standards of English, it's all about written English. I mean, there's nothing about kind of oracy or anything else, which is actually a skill that's increasingly more valued by employers and increasingly is one that's concentrated on more in secondary school. And I actually felt the report, you know, we'll see when we've had the wonky competition, but I felt it was an example of you can have competent grammar, but really poor communication, because this report really did not say a lot. And actually, one of the things it lacked was clarity. So not only did it not define what it meant by its much used phrase, technically proficient standard of English, but the case studies, and that's the way it was written, they kind of had these anonymous institutions contributing essentially to a desk review of documentation. They didn't speak to any academics, obviously. They spoke to a few senior managers about the scope of the review, but they didn't actually speak to any teachers or assessors. They just did a desk review of some documents. I think one of the things that they haven't really sort of focused on, because most university assessment policies, and obviously these things are very different by subject area and discipline, but they will refer to effective communication. So, you know, it may be okay to not mark down, doesn't mean you won't pick up, but it not mark down on a spelling error, as long as it doesn't compromise effective communication. And I think most university academic boards that I've ever sat in, that would be the thing that they would want to assess, effective communication. I don't think they necessarily would, unless it was very specific to the subject, want to start assessing technically proficient standards of English, not least because they might reasonably expect that is something that has been assessed lower down the education chain. And most universities will require a GCSE in English and maths before entry. I mean, there will be, you know, some sort of special conditions for those who don't have them. But I don't think most universities would see it as their assessment task, given all the other things that we're supposed to be concerned about, to be assessing technically proficient standards of English.
Amitai, you know, Selena gets to one of the vanishing points, doesn't she, here, which is, you know, in theory, one of the ways you can read this is, you know, OFS demanding that QAA unilaterally rewrites all its subject benchmarks to include, you know, proficiency in written English.
Yeah, and I guess there's another, I mean, I don't know whether the sector, as it were, as a collective, is actually going to respond. I mean, I doubt it. But I think there is a question here on what we know to be you know, the independence of institutions in this space, and whether or not on the list of, you know, priorities, this is something that the regulator needs to step in and regulate on. And I think there's a strong argument for saying that for the sector to potentially push back. I think the broader concern is the fact that this has appeared, this seems to be driven by press interest. I mean, there's a bit saying that there's a 2019 survey from the CBI from employers. I mean, I think what the fact that employers weren't spoken to as part of this exercise, I think, is a bit of a gap as well. If you were to ask employers what were the sort of the top, you know, things that you need improvements in terms of graduates with this feature, I don't know, but I think that should certainly have been in scope. And as I said, there's little engagement with students on this as well. So it does feel a bit concerning as to, you know, who is actually setting the agenda on what needs to be regulated. And I think it's a real shame that we've lost that, you know, potentially more kind of collective approach, that sort of co-regulatory approach that we may have had at points previously, because then you could get the sector agreeing to focus on things that, you know, the sector as a whole thought were important.
Instead it is policy making by, you know, the Telegraph, essentially, isn't it? I mean, you know, Minister reads a headline in the Telegraph or the Daily Mail, absolutely screeching headline, and calls up James Wharton.
Get your shopping done right this holiday season with Big Air Columbus. Right now, you can get $100 off Elite Player Passes at Big Air, which is unlimited play all day, any day. Or buy one $25 gift card, get a free pair of holiday grip socks, plus a 1.5 hour pass to use after the new year. Big Air is the perfect gift for the kids in your family. So get your holiday shopping done right with Big Air Columbus. Stop by today inside Fieldhouse USA at the Polaris Mall or online at BigAirUSA.com.
Says, you know, we've got to take action on this. And it's, and then James Wharton says, what can we do? And Nicholas says, well, we're going to have to stop the other, if you want us to look into this, chair, we're going to have to stop this other much more in-depth review about much more important things that we've already agreed that we need to be looking at. Are you sure you want us to do that? Because this, you know, isn't a real issue of concern outside of opinion writers in the Telegraph. Yes, well, it's of concern in the minister's office in Whitehall. So crack on, please.
But I think this is one of the things, Mark, which is, you know, it's what you might refer to as kind of the chocolate teapot policy. On the surface, it just looks like a useless thing. But actually, it's really dangerous.
Yes, I 100% agree with that.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, I dare a vice-chancellor to pop their head above the parapet on this one and say, do you know what? Actually, written English doesn't really matter for some subjects. I mean, it's a really bloody difficult thing to stand up and say, isn't it?
Clever politics, because it's a lose-lose for the sector. Because of that very reason, you can't push back against it. As much as I agree that it would be amazing if the sector would, but the optics of it are just terrible. You just have to duck and cover with this kind of stuff right now.
Yeah, but I think this is the thing. I mean, you know, press reports are not going to even read a 10-page font size 13 report. But actually, nobody is disputing that written English, written communication is important. I think, you know, if you actually look at the assessment policies, most of them will stress that effective communication is an important part of learning outcomes. What's being picked out here is very, very specifically spelling, punctuation and grammar. And I think, again, whilst, again, that's kind of important, it's not the whole piece in terms of what constitutes effective communication. And that's the thing that will mostly be looked at when somebody is marking a student essay. But we were just talking about essays there. The other worrying thing is here that actually this report reads as if all university degrees, you know, are based on written essays. And we know that a very big proportion are not.
Yeah, we're going backwards here. This is, you know, this is kind of sub-Victorian level of understanding of how education works. And
what about, I mean, their handwriting? That's what I want to know.
That's right. Yeah. Now should be seen but not heard.
Yes, and so on. Now, what should the HE sector prioritise to make real change on equality, diversity and inclusion in the year ahead? Wonky's editor Debbie McVitie has been trawling responses to our community survey to find out.
Hi, it's Debbie from Team Wonky, here to tell you about a brilliant event we've got coming up in partnership with Advance HE, all about equality, diversity and inclusion. It's called Living the Dream. It's on Thursday the 21st of October, and we'll be talking about building coalitions, strategies and leadership to deliver change across the whole of universities. We'll get a first look at the latest sector-wide data, we'll unpack the tricky idea of intersectionality, and we'll hear from the people who are working to make their dream of a more inclusive world a reality. Over the summer, we pulled Wonky Readers' views of equality, diversity and inclusion, and we found that there's a real appetite for greater cross-institutional coordination, more diverse representation in university leadership, and more opportunities to listen to and learn from marginalised voices. You can read more about those findings on wonky.com. So do please join us on the 21st of October. And if you're engaged in any kind of equality, diversity and inclusion work or advocacy, you can get a discounted rate. Find out more and get your ticket on wonky.com/events.
Now, finally, students are being told they must pass diversity and consent modules before they can begin their studies and are marked wrong if they don't accept their personal guilt. Amitai, what is the question to which online diversity courses are the answer?
So this has come from, well, there's sort of been a lot of reporting and pushback from the areas that you would expect around attempts that universities are making to include modules around equity, diversity and inclusion for students. A lot actually during the sort of induction and onboarding stage as well. And really that's about tackling the challenge around sort of the lack of understanding and what some people call, you know, racial literacy of students coming to higher education. And that's part of a wider drive to improve the experiences for students and staff of colour at universities. Understandably, understandably is generous. As one would expect, that's had quite a bit of pushback, and it's seen as sort of part. You know, it's been seen as this sort of it's gone straight into the culture war debate. It's seen as part of this attempt to, you know, it's a drive to make everything woke in universities, and lots of people are upset about it. I think what's quite interesting, though, from my personal perspective, at least, is that I actually don't think this is a particularly effective way of actually building people's racial literacy or understanding of equity, diversity, and inclusion issues. You really have, if you want to do this properly, you really have to get people in a room, a good facilitator who understands these issues, and talk this stuff out, get people to understand, to unpack their own biases, their own perspective, their own experiences, and to take them on that journey and understanding the implication of certain actions and behaviors, and you know, you need scenarios in there as well. So the whole debate is kind of going in circles, really, because you've got, on the one hand, some universities implementing this, I think, as a bit of a tick box. We can say we've got the training, the online training, bam, we've done it. That means that, you know, we've ticked that box in terms of, you know, on this issue. You really need to get people in a room to discuss these issues. And I don't think enough has been done there. But at the same time, even that, I mean, that's one step further, even that will cause, you know, lots of issues with particularly the right-wing media complaining about it as well. So, comes down to whether universities really have the stomach to make progress on this. But if they don't, the outcomes are not going to change. And that's the reality.
And I mean, this is interesting, isn't it, Selina? Because, you know, on one level, what you could argue is that Amate is saying, well, you know, these kind of online modules don't work. So if you really want to indoctrinate students, get them in a room, lock the door, and talk their racism out of them. Now, you know, on one level, that's about the kind of effectiveness of these approaches. But on another level, you know, I can see how people might write that up into something even more, you know, shocking than the way that these modules have been written up.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that there's two real questions here, which is, first of all, should universities, do they have the legitimacy to have expectations of community standards and values that go beyond what would be expected in everyday society? So, you know, within the current laws. And I think that's one question. I think the second is, then if it decides that there does need to be advocacy around particular issues, it, you know, is the kind of mandatory online training the right route to raise people's consciousness and get people to buy into that and surface some of the issues that people might have in relation to those subjects, whether it be, you know, racism, sexual harassment, whatever the topic is. And I think we kind of, you know, again, is this an issue that's really worthy of too much discussion outside the individual university concerned in terms of the online training? I kind of doubt that, because universities know their own audiences. These things need to be seen in the wider context of, you know, induction, reinduction. For some courses, it will be around professional standards and values. You know, there's lots of different ways in which these issues can be tackled. In my own personal view, I think most of the universities I've been at, most of these issues are better tackled at a local level within, you know, the smaller community that operates around the course. So certainly that would be what I would be looking for, rather than something that was rolled out alongside your health and safety manual training online module.
Yeah. Amitai, what is the right solution here from a sort of PR and media point of view? Is the trick here to sort of, you know, head down, the newspaper stories will pass, we're doing the right thing internally, let's crack on? Or is it that, you know, the sector should more perhaps forcefully make the case for these sorts of interventions, even if this particular intervention isn't particularly effective?
I think the sector should just do what is effective. Whatever they do, whatever they don't do, is going to be there's going to be pushback. And in fact, there's an argument to say that the more pushback, the more you know, some of this stuff might actually be working because it's showing that it is on the agenda. But so I think there's that element of it. Look, things are only going in one direction, and I think the sector just needs to knuckle down. I think the bit that's always missing from these conversations, though, and I guess it's partly because of the way they're framed, is, you know, what is the actual problem we're trying to solve here? And a lot of the people criticizing this don't have very many answers on that. And we don't talk enough about the actual tangible inequalities that there are in higher education, whether you're talking about the lack of diversity of staff, whether you're talking about unequal outcomes for students of color in relation to white students. So, and I don't think, and you know, there are actually very few debates about these issues. There's just, you know, one side and the other side, and they're shouting at their own constituencies and their own, you know, they're getting upset at each other, but I've not actually seen any debates about these issues, and that makes it really challenging, because the people who are saying, oh, this is all, you know, woke, whatever, there was a comment at Tory party conference actually where Oliver Dowden gets confronted by a member of the party saying, you know, would the suffragettes be woke, you know, today? Like, that's actually a very rare encounter, because people are not challenged on, okay, if you think that going down this route, doing this training, doing this thing is the wrong thing to do, how do you propose that we tackle these other inequalities that exist? This is part of what we're doing. And I think that's the bit that's missing. Journalists don't do it. You know, the media don't challenge on that front. So I think it's really about just bringing this back to whenever, you know, universities do or have to respond, it's bringing us back to that and saying, fine, you may not be happy about this, but what do you propose we do about the fact that, you know, there are no senior black academics in you know, universities? What's your solution to that? And I mean, they just don't have the answers. That's the reality.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our various subscriptions. So thanks very much to Selena, Amate, Mark, Mike, everyone at Team Wonky that makes the show happen. And until next week, stay wonky.
Columbus, it's Jenny and Bill from Simple Bath and Kitchen. Are you thinking about updating your bathroom or kitchen?
Don't call some big out-of-town franchise. We're local, top to bottom, right here in Columbus.
We know our city, we know the homes, and we always treat every project like it's our own.
On time, on budget, zero pressure. So you can actually enjoy your home.
Visit SimpleBathAndKitchen.com today.
We make it simple for you.
That's SimpleBathAndKitchen.com.
SimpleBathAndKitchen.com.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.